everyone. Welcome to Sources, Kane Academy's podcast on history and culture. I'm Andrew Zorneman, your host. In this episode, I interview Dr. Jonathan Sanford, president of the University of Dallas. Dr. Sanford is one of our nation's leading voices for liberal education and Catholic culture. I recorded the interview from Kane Academy's headquarters in Falls Church, Virginia. President Sanford joined me from the University of Dallas campus in Irving, Texas. I hope you enjoy this episode. President Jonathan Sanford, it's great to see you. I can tell you're in an office. I'm assuming that you are at the campus of the University of Dallas in Irving, Texas. Is that right?
I am indeed, yeah, in my office at the helm and at my standing desk.
Oh, that's great. Well, good for you. Yeah, I have my standing desk in the next room. I'm at the seminar room at Kane Academy in Falls Church. It's so great to see you again. The last time we saw each other was at the Classic Learning Test Summit Conference in Annapolis. I think that was in September. Yes. I wanted to start right off the bat with full disclosure to our audience that you and I go way back. Our relatives go even further back. Like I think my wife knew your parents when they were relatively newlyweds, and I think she probably knew the Sanford children when you were really young and might even have babysat for you.
But
you
would not be surprised if she was part of the army of babysitters.
That's right. Well, and but you and I go back to Trinity School at Greenlawn, where I was a teacher from 1983 to, 1997. And you graduated from there, and you and I had a chance to work together in a couple of different courses. I think you probably studied a couple of other things with my wife, Jeanette. I think maybe music, perhaps something
else. Yes, yeah. And work together is generous of you. I sat at your feet and learned a tremendous amount from you. You were my humane letters teacher for 2 years, both my sophomore and junior years. And those were absolutely formative in my education. And you were an inspiring exemplar for me, and a big part of the reason why I continued on the path I was set on through Trinity School and where I am today.
Well, I'm really encouraged by that, and I'm humbled too. And I think one of the most gratifying things for an old school teacher is to see a student develop and lap him and take on an important role. And I just hats off, you are now one of the leading figures in the education reform movement nationally. There is at the helm at the University of Dallas. We'll come back to Trinity shortly, but I thought maybe we could start, since you're standing at the helm, you're standing at your desk there at Dallas. Let's talk a little bit about Dallas. Sometimes I hear you talk, you give these really wonderful short videos, kind of encouragements to the Dallas community and to everybody who's looking in and wondering about the future of education in America. One of the things you talk about is Dallas as the leading liberal arts college in the country. And that's a bold claim, and I don't doubt it, but I'd like to hear a little bit about what you mean by liberal arts college, a liberal education, because the word liberal gets bandied about a bit. And in some circles, it's kind of in disregard. In other circles, it's mostly elevated to political meaning. But what do you mean by liberal education?
Yeah, great question. And there really is a distinction to be drawn between a liberal education and liberal arts in the traditional sense of the trivium and the quadrivium. And liberal arts and liberal education in higher education are often used, despite those differences, synonymously. And I try to be careful in the ways that I use them, but I slip sometimes and speak of the liberal arts as tantamount to liberal education. What I mean by liberal education is an education that liberates one from ignorance, from a overweening attachment to the passions, and liberates them for a life well lived. And that kind of liberation that enables one to live truly as a free person, the measure of which for the ancients, Aristotle in particular, is the way in which you use your time, in which you're not producing for your daily bread and other needs of your family? How do you use your leisure time? Do you use it excellently, or do you use it in ways that fall short of human excellence? So a liberal education, when I say it's oriented towards a life well lived, I mean principally, you know, how you use your time. But I think there's a way in which you can wrap the kind of work you do and how you do that work into ways that express the liberal education that one has received. One's genuine liberation is predicated on a significant education in the liberal arts per se. And I mean by that, you know, grammar, logic, rhetoric, and arithmetic and music. And so the trivium and the quadrivium, the three ways and the four ways that on the one hand teach us how to think well by making us attentive to our use of language, the rules of argumentation, the ability to defend oneself articulately, and the ability to listen attentively to an interlocutor. Those and more are contained within the trivium. And the quadrivium is particularly attentive to the way in which we encounter reality with our senses. And oftentimes, different ways in which number is involved in our experience of the world is used to talk about the four pillars of the quadrivium. And I think we can limit ourselves too much if we think of it just in terms of numeric value, in part because of the way that moderns have come to think about number. It's different than the ancients. But the spatio-temporal experience of the world. So, you know, with arithmetic and geometry, you know, both mathematical sciences were reflecting upon numbers per se, and then numbers spatially related. When we're looking at something like music, I think one can see music as the fine art, so to speak, and the engagement with the other arts are related to music. So if we think of music as only the study of music, I think that's too limited. It's in fact the way in which you get your hands dirty, so to speak, in an art studio as well. That's part of what I think one ought to imply when talking about music within the study of the liberal arts. Astronomy, right, might seem limited too, right? You just might have a course in the study of the stars, but that too relates to the other sciences as foundational disciplines, physics being the most basic of the sciences, and physics oriented towards an engagement with the cosmos as a whole. But biology and chemistry and other foundational sciences relate to that. So we immerse at the University of Dallas our students in both the trivium and the quadrivium through a 2-year sequence of courses. We are unique compared to some other universities that are heavy on the liberal arts in a couple of ways. One is with our science preparation, we make sure that our students, regardless of their major, will be in the labs doing real science, not baby biology, but legitimate biological research, legitimate work in the physics laboratory. We want them to experience the world with their senses and to understand not just the scientific method, but instrumentation and how that relates to engagement with reality. And then another distinctive is the both and of a 2-year core curriculum immersed in each of the liberal arts, translated across a slew of humanities and science and math and fine arts courses, and then a discipline, a major that builds upon that and prepares our students to move on into graduate work or right into industry or wherever they might be called. So it's also a core curriculum that's integrated across the whole student body, as opposed to just an area distributed approach to a general education, which is very common at liberal arts universities.
So if I hear you correctly, there's a wedding in the Dallas program between a commitment to modes of thought, ways of thinking about the world that could be represented, say, by the trivium and the quadrivium. You talked about music in a general way. You talked about science in a general way. But the rubber hits the road internal to the disciplines proper. So we want a student thinking scientifically, rationally, logically, seeking evidence for whatever he or she has to say. But concretely, the student's got to spend time in biology, physics, chemistry, and so forth. And so too, in the fine arts, it's not sufficient just to think about beauty or to talk about beauty or to even be trained broadly in music as a way of thinking or a way of engaging the world, but rather you got to take a music class, you have to take studio art class, you take drama or something like that. Is that a fair way to represent that?
That's right. And that's a way to connect to this emphasis on the senses, where you're making, you're doing, you're exercising the poetic arts of the human being through that kind of engagement. Yep. And, you know, I draw a lot from Newman, right? So we want our students to appreciate the fundamental disciplines that really make up our approaches to knowing reality. And we want them to raise the question explicitly, how do they all fit together? And philosophy is particularly important in that exercise, as is theology. And neither philosophy nor theology are traditionally part of the trivium or quadrivium, but they too are part of our core curriculum.
Yeah. Do you, in thinking that way, do you start from an anthropological position or perhaps a metaphysical one? And what I mean by that is, if we start with Aristotle thought we had a natural affinity for all things knowable. And the sense in which, you know, all knowledge begins with wonder, and each person has the capacity because of reason as part of human nature to engage the world and to understand it. The others might start from a metaphysical or an ontological axiom and say we deduce from that kind of a unity of truth, a unity of experience, and so forth. And is there an emphasis one way or another in the Dallas approach to liberal education?
Yeah, I think it's to build up to that unity. That is to say, to start with the particulars and to anticipate opportunities to glimpse elements of the unity, and then to more explicitly raise questions about how everything fits together, the unity of knowing as one makes progress. We forecast that in the way we talk about where one will go, right? We present a telos for the education, but you have to actually experience the particulars and wrestle with things as they present themselves to us, according to different modes of perception that track with these different disciplines.
And so is it fair to say then that the chief mode of learning for a student within a liberal program such as yours is inductive?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. At the classic learning test summit in Annapolis, you were on a panel with a couple of other college presidents, and you said something. I don't know if you knew this, but it kind of rocked the room a little bit. There wasn't a lot of discussion that came up about it, but at one point, the moderator was asking the three of you to comment on the relationship between a liberal education and virtue. And in the then right away, a distinction came or arose between intellectual virtues and moral virtues. And at one point you said rather boldly, that a liberal education won't make you good. And in other words, there were other things like pastoral training, spiritual formation, family, community, et cetera, that brings a person to what I think you were talking about is character, that is moral character. And can you, if you still stand by that, would you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I've been working on a piece articulating that. Yeah, so, you know, on the one hand, I think it's important to heed what St. John Henry Cardinal Newman recognized, that you can become a gentleman and not have a morally good character. You can become a truly well-educated in the liberal sense of education individual and not really be good. And I think you've got something close to virtues, but there's pseudo moral virtues in certain instances, and one can call to mind some really infamous examples. Alcibiades may not have been the best philosopher, but he certainly had philosophical pretensions, as at least he presents himself as a character in Plato's dialogues and Symposium in particular. And yet he's a wretch of a man. He's not a man of good character. And John Henry Cardinal Newman has this bold claim in The Idea of a University, in which he recognizes that there's a real danger in thinking that just cultivating the intellectual virtues will be sufficient. And I think that's right. And I think it's the particular charge of a university dedicated to the liberal arts, especially if it's a faith-based institution, in our case Catholic, to be attentive to the residential experience, the campus ministry, other elements of life, and ways in which professors themselves, as a kind of secondary work, exemplify good character to their students. But this is a question that goes all the way back to Aristotle and presaged in some ways in Plato. But can you in fact teach the moral virtues? And Plato and Aristotle both agree they can't be taught. That is, they can't be taught in a way in which they're really yours, right? They're acquired through habituation. They're acquired through practice. It's Aristotle who's most explicit about this. The intellectual virtues, on the other hand, those are a matter of teaching and of study. You can cultivate scientific knowledge through a careful study of the various disciplines and using science in that demonstrative sense, right? It doesn't just apply to the natural sciences. And I think that's right. And if you're going to evaluate a professor's performance in a principal way, are they instilling the intellectual virtues proper to their discipline in their students? But there's a secondary feature, right? Are they individuals of good character? Are they exemplars? The other side of this, and here's where I've been intrigued in thinking about what I've called the virtues of liberal education, to notice and find ways to articulate particular moral virtues that are necessary to successfully acquire the intellectual virtues. And I'm thinking particularly of intellectual humility, which I suppose you could make an argument is an intellectual virtue, but I think it's a deeper matter of character. Are you open to acknowledging your ignorance, right? Or does a kind of pride have its seat where that intellectual humility ought to
We
be?
could say the same thing of docility. So,
Yes.
intellectual humility and docility are awfully close to each other, but a willingness to learn from this teacher, a
That's right.
willingness to concede the better argument, those two things are distinct, but they're awfully close to each other.
That's absolutely correct. And I think perseverance in pursuit of what you are endeavoring to learn. I think a sense of wonder is more than just an intellectual disposition. I think that that's a matter of character. And I think acknowledging, recognizing, savoring, and learning to remember what you've learned, seeing it for the value that it has. There are elements of that are intellectual, and there are elements of that are really character-based and moral-based. And so I think without that assembly of moral virtues, you cannot as effectively acquire the intellectual virtues.
Roger Scruton uses the language of ought, both in the realm of moral philosophy and in aesthetics. And it's an interesting distinction and commonality at the same time. So in moral philosophy, you would say we make judgments about human action. But mm-hmm. in aesthetics, we make judgments about what humans make. So we say, we say a man ought to be courageous, you know, not reckless, not cowardly. But when we look at a painting, the language of art arises, or we listen to a piece of music, say, any kind of fine art, Scruton would say there are certain feelings that we ought to have. We ought to be moved by, say, Alyosha or Father Zossima and the Brothers Karamazov. We ought to be moved by the Pieta by Michelangelo. We ought to walk into a cathedral and be caught up in the architectural environment, which moves us to piety, to reverence, to, you know, humility, and so forth. What do you think about that distinction? Is that a good one to use? Or even though we're using the language of ought across the board, we think about moral philosophy as targeted toward human action and aesthetics toward things that humans make.
I think it's appropriate, and I think it builds upon resonances with ancient senses of beauty. Takhalon in Greek, the beautiful, is also translatable as the good and the desirable, right? And one ought to seek to reverence or perpetuate or magnify or replicate the beautiful. And Aristotle argues that virtuous actions are beautiful and done for the sake of the beautiful. He says that in both the Eudemian and the Nicomachean Ethics. Mm-hmm. And there's this mixing of what for us are distinct categories, the aesthetic and the moral, that I think ought to be mixed. And we have a richer experience of both the beautiful and the good when we recognize that there are certain obligations that we have towards both.
Yeah, very good. JJ, most of our audience on this podcast consists of secondary teachers in some version or another of a classical academy. It might be a public charter school, might be a Catholic or an ecumenical or an evangelical a classical academy. And so I thought it would be, as we said at the very beginning of the podcast, I thought we could come back to your own experience in secondary school, since mm-hmm. we had that common experience having worked together at Trinity School of Greenlawn in South Bend, Indiana. Remind me, please, did you graduate from Trinity? Is it 90, 91?
Actually, 93.
93. Okay, a little yeah. early there. Okay, so that meant that you and I were in class together in 90, 91, and 89, 90. So 89, 90 for 10th grade. And I remember, now that I think about it, right in there, I don't know if you remember, I brought in a tape of Margaret Thatcher's last day on the floor of the House of Commons. I don't remember that. Because in 10th grade, we're studying modern literature, modern European history, including British constitutionalism. Well, tell us a little bit about how your education at Trinity School of Greenlawn in South Bend, Indiana, prepared you for university studies at Xavier University, then graduate studies at the University of New York at Buffalo.
Thanks for that question. I mean, it's hard for me to tally the blessings of my education. And I will say that the reason I went to graduate school was because I felt that I had an unpayable debt. And the best thing I could do was to get as well educated as I could and teach other students. So I just begin with that expression of gratitude. You and so many other teachers I had at Trinity set me on a course, and I was blessed to encounter many wonderful professors, both in college and graduate school, who I was able to identify as good guides because of the excellent teachers I had at Trinity School. So it was the combination of the curriculum itself with the teachers. The you can have the most wonderful curriculum, and if you don't have teachers who live it, who communicate it, who inspire, and who hold their students accountable, it's merely a set of texts, a scope and sequence. Similarly, I know that there are many outstanding teachers who suffer within curricular structures that are less than ideal, and they even know it. And they are laboring to do as much as they can to bridge the divide between the more ideal and the reality of their circumstances. And Trinity was, in my experience, just uniquely conjoined with those two goods. That is to say, excellent teachers who really understood and lived the excellent curriculum that provided structure to the work we were doing. And I had outstanding colleagues. I work closely with one now, Andrew Ellison, who's the director of our St. Ambrose Center for Liberal Education and Culture at the University of Dallas, and
He was in
collaborates
your
with our
class at Trinity.
He was in my class at Trinity, and many others as well. And we pushed each other in the classroom. One of the things that I really appreciated about you was you were teaching us prudence, without saying I'm teaching you prudence, with respect to argumentation. And there were some seminars where we weren't engaged as we ought to be engaged, and you would say, come on, men, well, let's dig in. Don't you have a thought on this? And then more gently, there were a couple of times you took me aside after class, and because I tend to fall on the more argumentative side, and was occasionally I don't know, pugilistic perhaps in my approach, wanting to win the argument at all costs as opposed to finding the truth. And you found ways to get through to me that I needed to take a more gentle approach. And I had many other lessons from other teachers that were different from that, but similarly helped to refine what it is to learn how to argue without quarreling, and to argue in such a way that the truth is the prize here, or at least a greater vantage on the truth than you had before. And
The specific kind of argument, or that I should say, the specific pedagogical environment in which we were all polishing our arguments and arguing about things was the Humane Letters Seminar. And
That's right.
do you recount anything in particular about your experience in Humane Letters seminars, working through texts or having that around the table collaborative experience?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one was the variety of texts. So the Humane Letters approach gave us a heavy dose of history, of expository literature, of imaginative literature, of philosophical texts, at times theological texts. So the history was so important for understanding the broader context, and recognizing fundamental truths of the human condition, right? Building upon Thucydides's insight in the history of the Peloponnesian War that it's human nature that reveals itself in history, good or bad, and finding heroic types to emulate and reflecting upon that in the same context, the same semester, same year in which we're wrestling with the expository literature from that period of time. So the rootedness in the historical sequence was really important to me, and how I've approached other studies, and then attentiveness to the text itself. I entered Xavier University in order to take part in a program called Honorum Artis Baccalaureum, which was the old Ratio Studiorum of the Jesuits.
It was
the original college. I left Trinity without Greek, so I had to really accelerate my acquisition of Greek, but 4 years of Latin. And but in those classes, I was ready. Once I learned Greek, I was already ready with Latin, to be really attentive to the elements of the text that, as you squeezed it and appreciated the grammar, the context, learning how to ask questions, constantly asking the question, what is it that the author is answering in this part of the text right now, right? And so that orientation towards close reading of the text was absolutely valuable. And the teachers, and you were really a shining example of this, didn't leave us just by ourselves, right? So you were actually teachers. You saw where we needed to have some commentary help, some context, reminding us of where we are in the historical moment. And that was really helpful to get us back on to the study of the text. I had certain a funny experience when I was in graduate school. I picked up the idea that I really ought to not read any commentaries. And I remember I had to give a presentation on Aristotle's Categories, which I hadn't read before. And I spent a month reading it every single day, the whole text, and then taking it apart in Greek and English and different translations. And somebody just finally said to me, why don't you read some Porphyry? And I finally did, and I saw the connection between the categories and the topics, and it was illuminating. I realized somewhere along the way after Trinity, I picked up this idea that I shouldn't pay attention to what other people have to say before I decide what the text itself means. You can have an abuse of that desire to really understand a text. You can go obviously the other direction, and you're just looking for what other people think about a text. That's a mistake as well. And just like the moral virtues, one wants to find the mean. And so I think the last thing I'm thinking of right now with respect to that experience of the Humane Letters Seminar at Trinity was I was shown that mean and eventually learned to find it myself, and that's been tremendously helpful to the way in which I continue to teach students in my classrooms.
I'm so glad that you brought all that up. I think that there are wildly differing conceptions of what a seminar is across secondary and college education in America, from really good-hearted people who want to run a genuinely classical or liberal program. And mm-hmm. there's this one school of thought that says, yeah, you just give the students a great book, maybe you have one opening question, then you just let them go. And there's no sense of the teacher driving a dynamic conversation by asking questions into the text, keeping everybody accountable to rules of logic and evidence. And mm-hmm. and the teacher is not just the first learner. The teacher's also should be deeply learned and not only have read the text multiple times, but read secondary literature too. And so that mean that you just described, I think, also applies to secondary teachers, not just to university professors, as you put on your own. Two questions. Do you remember the Latin program at Trinity that you took that prepared you for a Ratio Studio?
Yeah, so it was Wheelock in ninth grade, and then sort of post Wheelock, just reading texts, a lot of Cicero, and in our sophomore year. And I had Mr.
Walker. By that, do you mean translation, or do you mean you were
translation? Mainly translation. One thing I hadn't done, probably the hardest class I had in college, was Latin composition, and it it revealed to me how one-directional my acquisition of Latin was, and that I wasn't yet really thinking in Latin. We had Ecce Romani in seventh and eighth grade, and each teacher I had supplemented with additional materials. Wheelock provided a kind of a full review of the grammar in our freshman year, and I know there are other grammar based approaches that might even be better than Wheelock now. But it was certainly adequate for me, and it gave me a certain love for the language. And I was not intending to go to college and study Greek and Latin, but I was intending to go to college and continue my liberal education. And when I was given a very generous scholarship from Xavier to do that in a way that included continued studies in Greek and Latin, it really fit that more fundamental desire that I had born from my experiences at Trinity. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Now, when you were in graduate school, I know you have a PhD in philosophy, but was the specific program you were in, was it of a particular emphasis, for example, the history of thought or ethics or Greek antiquity? What was the specialty there?
Yeah, so State University of New York at Buffalo is known for being the first place that phenomenology landed in the United States. Martin Farber had been a student of Husserl's and brought phenomenology back to the United States. Prior to the explosion of analytic philosophy within the world of philosophy, which is often split between analytic and continental, even more so when I was in graduate school, Buffalo was considered at the top of schools that approach philosophy with a strong historical perspective. There were a number of Straussian professors who had taught there. René Girard had been part of the department. And I was initially, they have a dual PhD program in classics and philosophy. And I had applied for the philosophy program and was considering the dual PhD track. And it was really family circumstances that led me to recognize that one PhD was enough, but they had a really good classics program that strengthened it. So wide exposure to the history of philosophy, and then you specialize in particular areas. And so in the philosophical sense, it was known as a pluralistic department. And I had a really outstanding ancient Greek professor who was on my dissertation committee who tragically died young. He was Chinese and studied at Padua, got a PhD in Canada, and then a long postdoc at Oxford. And he himself was very textually oriented just a wonderful teacher. So I learned a tremendous amount from him, and my PhD advisor had been a student of Etienne Gilson's and Father Joseph Owens at the Pontifical Institute for Medieval Studies. He was a large part of the reason why I applied to Buffalo, and he was the president of the American Catholic Philosophical Association.
Oh, yes.
Where I applied, Jorge Gracia was his name. He too has died just recently. And I co-edited with two of my friends who were also students of his, a Festschrift that came out just last year. He gave me a lot of freedom, even though he was a medievalist, a Suarezian, and we studied medieval figures together very closely to incorporate phenomenology, which I was interested in because of John Paul II. And I knew he had taken a real interest in Shaler. I wanted to understand what that meant. And
you read The Acting Person by then?
Yeah, I had read The Acting Person and some of his essays on community. And I wanted to understand what what it was all about. And Buffalo was a great place to do that because they continue to have a strength in phenomenology and in early realist phenomenology as well, which was particularly significant for John Paul's formation.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You went there because of Joseph Owens and their connections there with Catholic titans like Etienne Jouzon. And you are now the leader of a great Catholic university. Trinity School was ecumenical. And and there are ecumenical exemplars that, you know, we all are so grateful for. One thinks of Father Richard John Newhouse and his great work. He lived out the last years of his life in an ecumenical household. He founded First Things, of course, which is kind of his legacy and remains arguably the most important ecumenical journal in you know, the West, maybe. What about the ecumenism of Trinity School? Was that a factor in your good experience? Was it negligible? Was it in any way a preparation for later work as a Catholic leader?
Definitely, it was a deeply beneficial experience, and my parents remain part of ecumenical charismatic community. When it was first founded, it was Catholic. So my whole upbringing, although I'm a cradle Catholic, and that was always fundamental to our experience. I deeply treasure friendships I still have with friends of different religious backgrounds, and it we cared about the differences. And this is one of the things I love about Father Richard John Newhouse, right? That you don't put your differences aside in order to achieve a kind of false agreement. So I remember reading Paul's letter to the Romans together and faith and works and Calvin's approach or Luther's approach versus a Catholic approach. And it sharpened the edges of distinctions. And along the way, we appreciated each other more and more learned to stand up for some of those slight differences, but not in an antagonistic way. And, you know, the University of Dallas is certainly faithful to the magisterium, where we take our Catholic identity very seriously and are recognized by organizations for doing such, but we've always attracted students from a variety of faiths. We have faculty who are from a variety of faith traditions, even beyond the Christian sphere, and it's a Catholic view of liberal arts education that unites the place. And my reading of Ex Corde Ecclesiae, where John Paul II recognizes, and it's not a concession, it's a recognition of a good that a Catholic university should have professors from different faith traditions or no tradition at all, each of whom needs to express a strong support for the mission of the institution. But it's not just that there's a place, but a positive contribution that's provided by those who come in with a different faith tradition. And so we don't, I'll give you a current example. We've got this master's in classical education, and we partner with the Tikva Institute, which is a prominent Jewish organization in New York. And we built out a Jewish concentration within that. Rabbi Mitch Rocklin does some teaching for us in New York with teachers who are working within a network of schools that are promoting a classical and Jewish K-12 educational model. And that fits at a place like the University of Dallas. So there's, you know, that's perhaps even broader than the kind of ecumenism that you meant. It's interfaith, but all anchored under the Abrahamic religions. And I think my experiences at Trinity, my experiences growing up in my parents' home and their membership in the People of Praise was deeply helpful for preparing me to see how you can have both and you can be strongly Catholic as an institution and order the work of the whole and welcome contributions from those of different faith traditions within that institutional mission.
Wonderful. Well, I so appreciate your taking time to be with me in this podcast. And I'm so grateful too that we have the blessing of Zoom that we could confer together across half the nation, you there in the heart of Texas and here I am in Virginia. It's great to see you. Great talking to you. We're also grateful for your work at Dallas. And on a personal note, I'm so proud of you. I'm just really just so deeply proud that you've taken off to be a teacher. I love that sharing that you gave a little bit ago about why you went to graduate school to pay back in a sense of debt, because you've been given so much and you want to give back, and you had a heart for learning. You had a heart for the humanities especially, and look what you've done. You become a not only an excellent teacher, but a leader for teachers all across the country, in particular the great and dynamic community, University of Dallas. So congratulations.
Well, thank you, Andrew, I'm humbled, and I feel called to this work, and remain grateful to those who have shaped me. Thank you for making me the man I am.
All right. Great. Thanks again. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Sources. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with President Jonathan Sanford of the University of Dallas. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Our producer is Helen Gaworski. This is Andrew Zwerneman, your host. For all of us at Kane Academy, thanks again for listening to Sources.